Hi, everybody. My name is Bill. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Bill.
Hi, Bill.
Thank you for coming. I thoroughly enjoyed these sessions, so thank you for the opportunity to be of service and to share some stuff. Generally, when I go through the big book, I touch upon some of the things that we've talked about, but over the last few weeks, I've been able to like dive deeper in certain areas, and it's been nice. So thank you. Tonight, I'd like to talk about in the 12th step. It talks about practicing these principles in all of our affairs. So I'd like to talk a lot about principles to practice, because the book is filled with them, especially in the later chapters that a lot of people don't read. I'd like to start with, over the last few years, there's something that I've mentioned, and it's just like a little five-minute thing, and I sort of like sharing it because I think it could be helpful, and I think it's important. And that is what I would refer to as the essence of recovery. What is the essence of recovery? And there's a few things that I like talking about in regard to the essence of recovery, and that is, as far as I'm concerned, the essence of recovery is that we have to quit playing God. In other words, we have to surrender the illusion of control. I don't know about you, but most of the major changes that occurred in my life, I had no control over and I had no input on. Things just shifted, and I found myself in a completely different direction. And so that's the first part of it, is the essence of recovery, the essence of spirituality, the essence of life, really, is that we have to quit playing God. In other words, we have to surrender the illusion of control. The second thing I like talking about in regard to the essence of recovery is that life, recovery, spirituality is about relationships. And if you look at the steps a little bit closely, what you'll see is that in the first three steps, we get headed in the right direction with our relationship with God. In steps 4 through 7, we get headed in the right direction with our relationship with ourselves. In steps 8 and 9, we get headed in the right direction with our relationship with others. And then in 10, we deepen and broaden our relationship with ourselves. And in 11, we deepen and broaden our relationship with God. In 12, we deepen and broaden our relationship with others. So it's, and then, you know, Dr. Bob said, you know, trust God, clean house, help others. The three relationships again. Throughout the book, these three cycled relationships are mentioned over and over again. These are the only three relationships that you can be in: a relationship with others, a relationship with yourself, and a relationship with God. Now, part of how I sometimes talk about the relationships thing is, a bunch of years ago, I was at a Christmas party. And if you're going to have a Christmas party this year, don't invite me to it. Because I'm not sort of a regular kind of guy. I don't like talking about the weather. I don't like talking about, you know, how was your job. I like having real conversations. And I was at this Christmas party, and I noticed this new guy I had never seen before. He was, you know, early 20s, let's say. And I overheard him a little bit as he was having different conversations with people as he went around the party. He was telling people about how well he was doing spiritually. Now, I don't know about you, but usually if you're doing really well spiritually, you don't have to go around telling people that. You know what I mean? So that was the first red flag. And then when he finally got over to me and he started talking to me and he mentioned about how well he was doing spiritually, I said to him, you know, it's interesting for you to say that, but let me ask you some questions. And I said to him, how is your relationship with your family? Oh, you know, I hate them. I don't talk to them, you know. And then I said, how is your relationship with the people you work with? He goes, you know, I hate them. I don't talk to them, you know. And I said, well, you know, you just contradicted yourself. And he goes, what do you mean? And I said that, you know, if you're doing well spiritually, that has to do with relationship. So your relationships with your family would be really good, and your relationships at work would be really good. as well as other areas of your life. And, you know, of course, that's the quickest way to end a conversation, is to kind of confront people, you know what I mean? So that's why I said, don't invite me to your party, because these are the kind of things I do. But, and then the last aspect of the essence of recovery that I like talking about is many years ago, me and my original sponsor, Howard, we used to bring a meeting into the VA in Lyons VA. And it was every Tuesday at 7. And it was amazing, some of the things that happened at that meeting. Some of the most rewarding work that I've ever done with alcoholics and drug addicts happened at the VA. Because generally, the people that were there had some pretty extreme life experiences, for lack of a better expression. And Howard and I were the kind of people that can meet stuff like that in an accepting and a, okay, well, let's look at that kind of a way. And we would go through the big book, and then after we would go through the material in the big book up to step 3, we would all say the third step prayer together. And then we would say, okay, well, starting next week, if you want to continue with the steps, there's going to be a group of people upstairs that are going to help people take you through the fourth step and do your fifth step and go on with the rest of the steps. And if you don't want to have an experience with the steps, with the rest of the steps, then you can just stay here, and next week we're going to start again at the beginning of the book. And I remember one time when we were still toward the front of the book, there was about 5 minutes left for the meeting to end, and there was a guy in the back of the room, and he raised his hand, and he said, Bill, what do you think is the single most important thing about recovery? And my initial response was, there's only 5 minutes left of the meeting, and I can't BS my way through an answer that slowly, or that quickly. So I looked at Howard, and he looked at me, and I said, you know, we're toward the end of the meeting. I appreciate and see the seriousness of your question, and I'd like to meet the seriousness of your question with a serious answer. So you kind of caught me off guard, and during the next week, let me ponder your question, and I'll get back to you next week. And so the week went by, and I kind of sort of intellectually tried to go about coming up with an answer, and I came up with some answers off the top of my head that I thought were pretty good. And then, you know, later that day or a short time after I considered a certain answer, it just didn't resonate with me anymore. And the week went by, and I came back to the meeting, and I said, you know, the guy in the back, I just want to let you know I haven't come up with an answer yet, and give me another week, and I'll get back to you. And the second week, I did something that I've shared here, which is a deep spiritual practice that we've all experienced but hardly noticed, and that was that during the next week, I disregarded going about it intellectually, and I simply said, Lord, what is the single most important thing in recovery? The single most important thing. The single most important thing. And then I didn't think about it anymore, and I just went about my week. And later that week, this thought came into my head, and as soon as I heard it, I said, that's it. That's the single most important thing about recovery. And I went back to the meeting, and I excitedly shared, you're not going to believe this, but I actually came up with an answer, and I'm very happy with it. And that all happened, you know, 20 years ago, and I'm still very happy with the answer that we shared with him that night. So I just wanted to mention that.
I already know it.
And the answer that came to me that day, which didn't come from me, was consistency. The single most important thing about recovery is consistency. Because you see, if you're working like a really good program and you're consistent with it, you're going to see that that program really, really works. And if you're working a really, really lame program and you're consistent with it, what you're going to discover is that program really sucks. And I need to really quickly point out that consistency is one of the most difficult things for an alcoholic to do. And I know that because I know that about me. But, you know, the step work that somebody did 10 years ago and then hasn't really played with any much after that that's not going to be helpful to you today. But if you've been consistent with the design for living in the big book, which is the 12 steps, then and only then will it continue to have its vitality and continue to have its transformative, powerful, satisfying effect. So when that answer happened upon me, like I said, that was, you know, 20 years ago, and it still resonates with me strongly that consistency is the most important thing. Now, then that precipitates a next important question, and that is, consistent with what? Because, you know, like, consistent with what? And some things that I'd like to talk about tonight is, you know, what are principles to practice? And as I see the 12th step in the big book, it's found in working with others, to wives, the family afterwards, to employers, and a vision for you. As far as I'm concerned, that encompasses all of step 12. There's some people that think that just working with others is step 12. Working with others is just instructions on what to do, what not to do, what to say, what not to say when working with people. But the aspects of practicing principles in all our affairs, the aspects of a little bit of a description of the spiritual awakening that's talked about in the beginning of the 12th step on the window shade, I'd like to play with the part of principles to practice. And all of the material, almost all of the material I'm going to cover is in a handout that everybody's going to get at the end. So you don't necessarily need to sort of follow along, because you're going to get a total guideline with page and paragraph of each of the things that I'm going to discuss. So personally, what I've been trying to do at this workshop is to make it sort of experiential as opposed to informational. And so people have come to me and said that they really picked up on that. So especially today, I'd like to suggest that as I go through this material, experience it in my presentation almost like a meditation. And get a sense of, as I read certain things and maybe discuss it slightly, get a sense of where within you practices like this would come from, because ultimately that would be the most successful way of doing this. So I'd like to suggest that to you right up front. Now, I'm going to go through a bunch of stuff into wives and the family afterwards, and hopefully I'll get to some stuff from two employers. But there's also stuff toward the, you know, other parts of the book, the beginning part of the book, that also has principles to practice. And I shared one last week where it talks about, you know, love and tolerance of others is our code. Those are principles to practice. In the 10th step on the window shade, it talks about, you know, when wrong, promptly admit it. Notice that it doesn't say when wrong, promptly explain it. That's a very important distinction. Don't internalize it incorrectly. Some people haven't heard this phrase before, but there's a big difference between 9th step amends and 10th step amends. In other words, 9th step amends generally is, I got sober, and hopefully in a brief period of time I started getting to the steps. But, you know, stuff that I'm going to make amends for happened years ago, or months ago, or decades ago. And then in the 9th step, we put together a list and we go out and we make amends. 10th step amends is on the spot. And it's a little more humbling. As a matter of fact, it's a great more humbling. And it's a lot more difficult because, you know, there's only one thing worse than I can't believe I did that. And that is, I can't believe I did that again. And, you know, on the spot, saying to somebody, I'm sorry, you know, I overreacted, you know, I'm sorry, I didn't treat you very nicely, you know, I'm sorry, I lied, I don't know why I said that, that was absolutely not what was going on, you know, I'm sorry, I wasn't there for you, I'm sorry, I wasn't listening, you know what I mean? These are the kind of 10-step amends, which is on the spot. Very, very rewarding, though. Very, very rewarding. It's funny because I found, as a matter of fact, there's a gentleman here, Darren. He's a longtime friend of mine. We hadn't been in touch for a while, and now we're in touch again. Me and Darren used to work together, and we used to party together. And we had a really good time. We were really, really good friends. We were like inseparable. And then I got sober, so there was sort of a little bit of a lifestyle shift, let's call it. And then a few years later, he contacted me and he said, "Bill, you know, I have a problem and I need help." And you know, he started going to AA and NA, and you know, it's a beautiful thing to see. But you know, when you're out there, there's these things that just happen. There's these things that just happen, and sometimes it matters, and sometimes it doesn't matter. But friendship is more important, and being real is more important. And you know, sometimes you find yourself, you know, with your wife or your husband or with your girlfriend or with your boss. And you know, when I was out there, I would suggest that I became a pathological liar. As a matter of fact, my first drug of choice was lying. And because that was where I learned how to twist reality. And and then I get sober, and, you know, in the first paragraph of How It Works, which is the single most read piece of literature in all of AA. The How It Works reading is the single most read piece of literature in all of AA. You hear it every week, everywhere. And in the first paragraph, it talks about honesty three times, and the last time it talks about demands rigorous honesty. These are principles to practice. And, you know, but I'm a pathological liar, so what do you do with that? You know what I mean? Like, I would just lie for no reason. I would say something and say, "Why did I say that? I wasn't even trying to impress them. I'm not trying to gain a point. Why did I say that?" You know what I mean? And now I'm in the middle of the steps, and I'm like, you know, how do I deal with this? I don't know how to deal with this. And I didn't actually address it with my sponsor, and I didn't discuss it with anybody. There was something that came up within me that said, you know, that's it, no more. From now on, whenever you lie, mid-sentence you stop and you say, "I'm sorry, I don't know why I said that, that's not what's going on," and then tell the truth. And what's interesting is that as soon as I started to be committed to that, before I started really doing it, there was this revulsion within me of my ego saying, "No, that's a really bad idea. Don't do that. Don't know." And I was just absolutely committed. And, you know, during the next week or whatever, I found myself saying things, and then I stopped and said, "I'm sorry. I don't know why I said that. That's not what's going on. This is what's going on." And my mind told me that, you know, now nobody's going to trust me because, you know, I'm admitting that I'm a pathological liar. And what was strange was the first times that that started happening, two things happened. One was, it was amazing how beautifully it was met by the other person. I would be saying something, and I'd be like, "You know, listen, wait a minute, that's not what's going on. I don't know why I said that. You know, this is the truth. This is what's going on." And the other person would say, "Wow, Bill, you know, I really respect you for doing that. I wish I could do that. Because sometimes I say stuff that's not the truth." And what was interesting was my mind was telling me, "This is a bad idea. You know, you're going to lose friends because of it." And what I discovered was that people actually respected me more for doing it. And then, you know, after you're committed to really, really telling on yourself, then, you know, you just stop yourself kind of before, because, you know, now you're going to have to sort of embarrass yourself again. And, you know, just over a pretty short period of time, it all got reversed because I was absolutely committed to calling myself on the whole thing. And it went really, really well. You know, principles to practice. Then on page 19 at the bottom, it says, "Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. Our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs." Now, there's two things there that are repeated over and over and over again in the book. One is, most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints. It's not just, you know, fake sort of surface kind of tolerance. It's talking about real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. And then, you know, the second part is I mean, I personally have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 references to it saying that, you know, our very lives as ex-problem drinkers depends on our constant thought of others and how we may help them. You know, a big part of our program is thinking about somebody else, and a big part of our problem is thinking about ourselves. So, you know, over and over again, it talks about that. And I also want to point out that it says that, you know, real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions and attitudes, that does include your home group's business meeting. So good luck with that. Like I said, you know, in 10 it talks about admitting it when we're wrong. You know, like I said, the love and tolerance of others is our code. You know, it's sprinkled throughout the book. But in To Wives, The Family Afterwards, and To Employers, it's amazing. You know, just the list that I put together is 87 principles to practice as a way of life, basically. And, you know, it's important to see. Now, I don't want to minimize this by, maybe you're new, so you can just disregard what I'm about to say. I'm not saying that. But I do want to point out that, you know, this is toward the end of the process. So we're a little bit more spiritually centered and we're a little bit more spiritually awake. So this isn't necessarily going to be, you know, getting great results, you know, as a new person just coming to AA. So I just want to point that out too. All right, so I'm not gonna. You guys are gonna get it in the handout, so you can cross reference the handout. I'm just gonna read them, and like I said, what would be really great is if you could almost like receive it like a meditation. And I'm just gonna kind of read it, and sometimes I might explain a little bit, and sometimes I might just go on to the next one. So, you know, let's just you know, be one with this and see, get a sense of sort of where it comes from within yourself. Because, you know, it's always easy. I was in Staten Island one time when I did this presentation, and people came up to me afterwards and said, you know, yeah, that might be how it is in New Jersey, but this would never work in Staten Island. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know how to respond to that. You know what I mean? Like, I completely understand what they're saying, because the people in New Jersey said, you know, maybe in Staten Island, but not in New Jersey. You know what I mean? But, you know, there's a place within us that can come from this, and that's what we need to cherish, and that's what we need to get more and more in touch with, because this comes from a deep spiritual place. So let me begin. This is from To Wives. The first principle of success is that you should never be angry. Now, I did a whole thing on resentment a couple weeks ago, so I'm not going to go through that again. But, you know, there's a principle to practice. Then the next one, patience and good temper are most necessary. Patience and good temper. Another one, our next thought is that you should never tell others what they must do. Now, this is to wives, so this is in relationship. You know what I mean? Like I said last week, love means as is. We need to allow someone to be as they are and allow them to be however they show up. We need to find a way to be right with it. And then it says in the next line, it repeats it, do not set your heart on reforming. Then it says, your mate would appreciate your reasonableness and patience. So there's some more principles to practice. Reasonableness and patience. And then it talks about, you know, if you're having, you know, let's say an argument or a discussion, be sure that you are not critical during such a discussion. Not being critical. Keeping it to yourself. You know, that was something I didn't pick up on initially. When I started my amends, I was doing it wrong in some cases. And it was immediately noticeable. And what I mean is that there were times where I would go to somebody and say, you know, I'm really sorry that I did this, but, you know, you did that. You know what I mean? That's called an amend that you need to make another amend for, which you want to avoid like the plague. Then it says, attempt instead to put yourself in their place. So don't personalize. Don't make it personal. Try to understand where they may be coming from. put yourself in their place. That famous Native American phrase that, you know, you don't know anything about somebody until you walk a mile in their shoes. You know what I mean? That's also one of the four agreements talks about, you know, don't take things personally. It's not an easy thing to do. And it's very contrary to how mostly we lived our lives. So, you know, something to focus on. Let him see that you want to be helpful rather than critical. You know, we can show somebody that we're coming from a place of love. You know, something I overlooked saying last week in the love workshop is that love is not a feeling. Love is not an emotion. Love is a decision. That's one of the most important things I could say about love. It's not a feeling. It's a decision. In other words, real love doesn't begin until the feeling of love starts to fade. In other words, the honeymoon phase of a relationship doesn't have anything to do with love. It's the honeymoon phase of a relationship is the joke that the universe plays on us to get us to hook up with somebody. And then reality kicks in and the real work needs to start to happen. And I remember, you know, it's interesting, I was at a retreat one time and I was having a conversation with a guy. And he was talking about he was going to break up. He was on the retreat and he was contemplating he was going to break up with his girlfriend. And I was like, how long have you guys been together? And he shared that with me. It was probably about 5 years. And I said, the last time you talked to me, you were talking about getting married. What's going on? Like, what happened? What shifted? And he said, you know, I just don't feel it anymore. And then I sort of prompted him a little bit because I wanted to see, you know, is it just gone or is it just that the emotion is going? And it became really obvious to me that it was just the emotion that was going. And I was like, you know, welcome to the relationship, dude. You know what I mean? Love is not an emotion. It's a decision. It's a decision to love even when I don't feel like loving. It's a commitment. And it's really interesting because that conversation ended up being relatively brief. And a few months later, I ran into him at the Saturday Burnsville meeting. And he had just gotten engaged. And he thanked me. And his girlfriend thanked me because he told her what we talked about. And he told her where he was at. And she said, yeah, you know, I too was having some doubts. Or I too was not feeling it. But she shared with him, but, you know, Maybe I loved you a little bit more than you loved me because I intuitively, you know, women intuitively kind of know these things, that I intuitively knew that it wasn't about the emotion, that I was just committed to you and that's what I was focusing on. So she was ahead of him with this. And then, you know, I kind of caught him up, let's call it. And it's a beautiful thing. I haven't seen him in a while, but the last time I saw him, which was not too long ago, they were still married. So it's an interesting thing. Then it says, but you must be on guard not to embarrass or harm. One thing about close personal relationships is we know where all the buttons are. I remember after I first got sober, like the first year, I used to call my family the land of the button pushers. Because I would go up and spend time with my family and it was always really hard. But what was cool was as I worked the steps and as I tried to go spiritually, the buttons started to go away or they started to move and it wasn't so easy to push my buttons. So it wasn't about them at all. Then it says, it is best not to take sides in any argument. And this might be argument, you know, with others or argument about others or whatever. Kind of trying to stay neutral. It's funny because those last couple, the essence of love is really there. Then it says, use your energies to promote a better understanding all around. There's a mantra we could work with for the next week, you know what I mean? Trying to have a better understanding. And part of having a better understanding, as far as I'm concerned, is there's something a few years ago that I really focused on and I really drilled down on that's been one of the most rewarding things that I've ever done, and that is learning how to practice genuine listening. In other words, most of us in conversation, we're just waiting for the other person to finish so we can talk. And that's not genuine listening. And mostly that's how we are, but it's not genuine listening. And in practicing talking less and listening more, it's amazing how it's flourished some relationships that were, you know, not as good as I had wished they'd be, and some really incredible experiences with family relationships that, you know, we were in the same family, we didn't even know each other. And just because I was taking an interest in wanting to get to know them, instead of putting my stuff on it, that it created a closer relationship. And it's a really beautiful thing. So it's one of the most profound things I've ever worked with. Genuine listening. I mean, think about this for a second. Imagine if you really just listen to your kids, not waiting for them to finish or not waiting to correct them. Absolutely amazing. Absolutely amazing. Kids have so much more to give wisdom-wise than we do. Because they're fresh. They're innocent. They see it as it is without an intellectual translation of it. They could teach us a lot more than we could teach them. Then it says again, be careful not to be resentful. And like I shared in the resentment session that I talked about, resentment comes from our judging and then finding them guilty. So we start way before the resentment. We start at not judging anymore, trying to move away from that. Because the judgment's what creates the resentment. Then it says, now we try to put spiritual principles to work in every department of our lives. You know, in reworking the steps, when you go back to the first step and start going through it again, what I discovered was is that the areas of my life that I'm not including God, those are the areas of my life that I'm going to be doing inventory on at some point in the near future or distant future or whenever I do inventory next. The areas I'm not including God. In other words, the areas of my life that I'm not including love, that I'm not including integrity, that I'm not including truth, those are the areas of my life that begin to get out of control and begin to be unmanageable. And I'm going to need to inventory that. So the 12 steps are not just something we do and then, okay, well, now what? The 12 steps are designed for living that we practice in all of our affairs. And nobody ever said that it was going to be easy. But you see, there's only one thing more difficult than working all 12 steps in a quality way. And that's not working all 12 steps in a quality way. It's funny because like sometimes our mind will tell us, you know, this is too much. Why would I bother? But then we look at our lives and we see how much of a nightmare it is. And how out of control and how unreasonable and how suffering we create into it. And trying to live the spiritual life and trying to practice these principles and trying to work the steps as a design for living in all of our affairs. Not just as a four-step way of doing the past and dealing with the past, but as using a resentment inventory and a fear inventory to deal with when fear and resentment comes up in the present. As a way of life, as we go about our life. So in every department of our lives. Then the next one, faith and sincerity should be regarded as part of your education, for thus you will be learning to live. So it says faith and sincerity. So thine own self be true. If I don't more deeply have a relationship with myself and I don't more deeply get to know me, I have nothing to share with another human being, because if I don't know me and I don't love me, then I can't love you, because I can't give something that I don't have already for myself. I can't be honest with you if I'm not honest with me. Really, really important. And really, really hard. Then it says, just be careful not to disagree in a resentful or critical spirit. Again, repeating the important stuff. Patience, tolerance, understanding, and love are the watchwords. Show your husband these things in yourself, and they will be reflected back to you from him. Live and let live is the rule. You know, acceptance of others. If you both show a willingness to remedy your own defects, there will be little need to criticize each other. You know, it talks about in the 12 and 12 that anytime we're upset, no matter what the reason, there's something wrong with us. That it's a spiritual axiom that anytime we're upset, it's because there's something wrong with us. Yeah, it's because we're upset. When you're upset, that automatically guarantees that you're hooked up with the mind and you're hooked up with the story, and you got to find a way to unhook. It's spirituality is simply that easy. As soon as you find yourself uncomfortable, frustrated, angry, suffering, it guarantees that you believed the thought that was left unquestioned. And as soon as you start to question it, then that begins to release it. Then it says, when resentful thoughts come, try to pause and count your blessings. A little gratitude inventory there. Just like in the 11th step where it says, you know, we pause when agitated or doubtful and ask for the right thought or action. Now notice what it's saying there. We pause when agitated or doubtful. Agitated is way before pissed off. Doubtful is way before we're in deep doo-doo. You know what I mean? In 10 and 11, it dives deep into we have to be in touch internally with our emotions, with our intuitive, and with our mind to see when these things first start to crop up before the momentum starts when it's too late. I don't know about you, but man, I've had some momentum that I was going way downhill and it was a huge snowball, you know what I mean? It's like, too late now, you know, too late now. I've committed to hanging on, you know? We all have a Grand Central Station mind, but we don't have to get on every train that comes through the station. I'm telling you, I can't tell you. I mean, I'm talking about thousands of times I've said to people that called me, dude, you got on a train, just get off. Train of thought, that's it. You got on a train, just get off. It's almost as easy as that. But the thing is that the mind is so convincing, you know what I mean? It's so convincing, you know what I mean? No, you don't understand. You know, like I'll say, you know, you're on a train. Get off the train. You don't understand. You know, you don't understand. No, this time it's real. No, it's not real. Anytime I'm upset, there's something wrong with me. The only problem we have is an unquestioned thought. If you cooperate rather than complain, you will find that his excess enthusiasm will tone down. So they're talking about, you know, sometimes when we first come in here, we kind of go overboard with service, and we go overboard with the amount of meetings we go to, and we go overboard with being all enthusiastic about this new guy that they just met, and we have kids at home that we're hardly enthusiastic about at all. It's definitely a pendulum, and it does swing back. So, you know, if you see it in someone you're close to, you know, this too shall pass, you know. It says, both of you will awaken to a new sense of responsibility for others. Some of the greatest joys in my life have been in working with others. And then what's really cool is seeing friends and sponsees being of service to others. I can't tell you the feeling I had the first time that I saw, I had taken somebody through the big book, and they had a really nice experience. And then they were meeting somebody an hour before the home group, and they were sitting in the corner taking somebody through the work. At that point in my life, it was like the proudest moment of my life. I was just like, look at this guy. This is what it's about. You, as well as your husband, ought to think of what you can put into life instead of how much you can take out. You know, again, thinking about somebody else is a big part of our solution, and thinking about myself is a big part of my problem. Then it talks about if someone relapses. You know, it's interesting. This is on page 120 in the big book. It's page 120, toward the middle of the book. It says, it talks about, as a matter of fact, let me just read it in its entirety, because so many people in AA don't even know about this. So often, you know, somebody relapses and we tell them, oh, you need to go to more meetings or whatever. Notice what the big book says. It says, though it is infinitely better, this is right in the middle, like about a third of the way down, though it is infinitely better that he have no relapse at all, as has been true with many of our men, it is by no means a bad thing in some cases. Your husband will see at once, that he must redouble his spiritual activities if he expects to survive. You need not remind him of his spiritual deficiency, he will know of it. Cheer him up and ask how you can be still more helpful. So it's talking about part of how we can redouble our spiritual activities is maybe we go to more meetings, but it's certainly vastly more than that. The book even talks about what happens if you relapse, and hardly anybody knows about it and rarely talks about it. If a repetition is to be prevented, place the problem along with everything else in God's hands. Again, we have to quit playing God, the essence of recovery. In other words, we have to surrender the illusion of control. We will never know the big picture, but we can know the one who does. Placing it in God's hands. God's will, not mine, be done. In step 2 of the 12 and 12, in step 10 of the 12 and 12, in step 11 of the 12 and 12, in step 10 of the big book, in step 11 of the big book, it says the same thing. God's will, not mine, be done. This is the AA mantra. As far as I'm concerned, this is the AA mantra. Mantra is usually a word or a brief phrase that has spiritual power. God's will, not mine, be done. It's interesting how the minds will come up with a plan on how we want it to go. But if we're able to disregard that and say, God's will, not mine, be done, however it turns out, can be accepted because it's not up to me. It just makes the whole thing a lot easier. One of the phrases I like using is, there's a big difference between making it happen and letting it happen. I mean, you can just get a sense of those two phrases even emotionally. Like, make it happen, that's a lot of pressure, and that's a lot, you know, that's a lot. Like, you know, letting it happen, it's like, you know, the shoulders go down, you know, the energy shifts. I can just let it happen. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, someone is running toward you with a knife and you just let it happen. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, that, you know, this is not what I'm talking about. Obviously. Maybe you could do like a karate flip, you know, and like he goes right by, you know what I mean? Like that, but that's letting it happen. The letting it happen is the emotional and the story response to it. You know what I mean? Letting it happen is, oh wow, you know, that guy came at me through a knife and I'm on to other things. Making it happen is, he shouldn't have done that, and you know, now I got to go out and you know, do this, and you know what I mean? Like, that's where the story kicks in, and that's where the suffering and the silliness starts to happen, is the story we put on top of it. But just letting it happen is just being in the moment and just letting it happen, but responding appropriately. You know what I mean? And then now we get into family afterwards. All members of the family should meet upon a common ground of tolerance, understanding, and love. Again, sort of repeating some there. The other person shouldn't be reproached, which means criticized. Another one, we grow by our willingness to face and rectify areas, errors and convert them into assets. In this part of the book, again and again, it talks about that, the worst things can turn into the best things if we use them spiritually. And it makes no sense whatsoever, right? It doesn't make any sense. That's not good math, right? That's not good math. The worst thing is the worst thing, and it's got to be categorized that way. And then somebody shares, and we share something that was the worst thing that we ever did or something, and it brings relief to them because they're like, oh, wow, you did that too. And they don't feel so lonely, and they don't feel so judged. And they don't feel so unique. And notice what it says there. We will grow by our willingness to face and rectify errors. You know what I mean? It's okay to be imperfect. But I'm sorry to have to tell you this, but life is perfect. And it's funny because people have an issue with that whenever I talk about that. Life is absolutely perfect. When we experience nice things, it's almost like vacation, and it's sort of cool. You know what I mean? It's nice. It's a nice experience. But when we experience harsh things, what that is an opportunity to grow up. What that is an opportunity to grow spiritually. And that's what life throws at us, generally. I mean, there's some neutral things, but generally there's good things, and those are kind of cool, and, we kind of like those. We don't have a problem with it. But when the harsh things happen, really it's just a flashing sign saying, okay, time to grow up, how can I use this spiritually? We talk to our network, we talk to our sponsor, we share at a meeting. We throw out an issue or a problem that we have, but we also share what steps and spiritual practices we're using to deal with it, which then changes it from a problem meeting to a solution meeting, and then we're more helpful to newcomers. They're just not, newcomers and old-timers because, think about it. Old-timers have been sitting there for 40 years listening to our problems. And I don't know about you, but the mind is not very original. Like, I've listened to over 500 fifth steps. It's been a long time since I heard anything new. Please, somebody share something that I've never heard before. Please. The mind is so predictable and so pathetically unoriginal. And we think we're so original, you know what I mean? Like you know... Cling to the thought that in God's hands, the deepest past is our greatest possession you have. The key to life and happiness for others. The key to life and happiness for others. The worst things that we've experienced. Wow. What a promise that is. What a reversal that is, right? We think, woe is me. The lower the bottom you've had, woe is me, right? That's what people will co-sign, and that's what your mind probably told you your whole life. No. The lower your bottom is, the more that can be turned around for your spiritual growth. And then that's more people that you can help come out of the cave of their stupidity. These things that we call bad, these things that we call harsh, are gifts. When was the last time that was a topic at your home group? You know what I mean? This is what the book is talking about. What a beautiful message. Life is perfect. It says we do talk about each other a great deal, but we almost invariably temper such talk by a spirit of love and tolerance. Again, love and tolerance. It's gotten to the point now where mostly, I try to reject gossip in conversation. And mostly, I might just walk away because I have no right to suggest what other people should do. But there have been times, you know, maybe I'm with some sponsees or some friends where we kind of call each other on stuff. If I don't choose to just walk away, I'll often say, you know, can we just talk about something else, because I'm not really interested in talking about gossip. Sometimes the other people think I'm judging them. And I'm not. I just don't want to talk about it. I'd like to stay in this conversation. I don't want to talk about this. It's something to look at, because, you know, there was a book that I read, and it had a bunch of exercises. And one was, over the next week, write down in your conversations how often the conversation was about gossip and about other people. And you will be horrified if you work with that exercise, because it's mostly that. It's mostly about that. We love talking about other people, because then we don't have to look at ourselves. And then it says that, you know, we do not relate intimate experiences of another person unless we are sure that they would approve, or, you know, maybe even have gotten their approval. You know, there's stories that I've told in workshops, and I've asked people ahead of time, you know, would it be right if I talked about this, because this is like a really great example. Then it talks about praising another's progress. Very often, we don't see it in ourselves, but somebody else notices that, wow, I've changed. And it's really, really wonderful to hear from somebody, you know, Bill, you really handled that well. You know, it's funny, because I had this conversation with my dad one time, and he was talking about that I should go back to church. And we had a little bit of a conversation, and I threw in genuine listening, so I wasn't in debate mode, because debate mode is not a good thing in my case. Because debate mode means I'm not listening to you, and I'm not considering what you have to say. And you're not right, right? Debate mode is you're not right. You know what I mean? Sorry, you know, debate mode, you know. It's not a happy part of my system. And I listened to my dad, and he shared some things. And he didn't feel rushed, and he didn't feel disrespected, and he didn't feel not heard. And I said to him, Dad, I absolutely respect what you're saying, and I completely hear what you're saying, but I see it differently than you do. And then I walked away. Because you see, when you say that, the other person turns into debate mode. Because they think they haven't convinced you yet. And that's not the case here. I said, I totally respect what you're saying, and I totally hear what you're saying. It's just that I see it differently than you do. You're being very clear that you're not disagreeing with them, and you're not saying they're wrong. You're just saying you see it differently than them. It throws them into confusion, actually, because they're not sure how to respond to that, because, like, they have nothing to play with. You know what I mean? They have nothing to grab onto. They have nothing to debate or argue. And it was just another one of those moments that I've had with my parents, which both of them, I've had some really incredible moments that were just, well, I guess the best way I would describe it is very adult. Because I don't know about you, but, you know, up until I really started working the steps and I really started to grow spiritually and I really started to take responsibility and all of that, my relationship with my parents was always, they're the parents and I'm the kid. And this is how it is. You know what I mean? They're always talking down to me. You know what I mean? Which is not something I respond well to. And at first, you know, it was just accepting what the relationship was like. And then they started seeing that something was happening with me that was adult. And that I was paying my bills. And that I was showing up what time I told that I would show up. And I would try to be happy when I was with my parents. Because when I made amends to them, they said, well, you know, we just always wanted you to be happy. Which equals, whenever I'm with my parents, I'm going to try to be happy. Because that's all they wanted from me. And I never showed up that way. And then we were able to have adult conversations. And sometimes I helped them in a conversation. So, you know, everything shifted with my parents. To the point when at my mother's deathbed, at the moment of her death, I was all right. It was one of the most beautiful experiences I've ever had, because we were just even, and we were just current, and we were just all right, and we were in love again. And the experience of being at the deathbed of my mother was 10% grieving and 90% gratitude that I ever even knew that woman, because she was really a wonderful chick. She was very special. And I pushed all that away. Most of my life was dedicated to pushing all that away. I tortured the people that loved me, and I tortured the people that were close to me. And that was on a good day. I ripped emotional security from the people around me. I ripped emotional security away from the people around me. And then And then you people came into my life and said, perhaps there's another way. And this is what really has worked for us. And then I tried it, and it really worked for me. And it's a miracle. How do you go from the way we were to how we are now? You can't get there from here without the X factor called God. Another principle we observe carefully is that we do not relate... Oh, I read that already. It says they should be thankful he is sober and able to be of this world once more. So again, you know, showing gratitude and thankfulness. Praise his progress is the next one. Again, another one, tolerance, love, and spiritual understanding. I sort of like that phrase, spiritual understanding. It's a little bit deeper than understanding, right? You know, spiritual understanding is other elements are now involved. You know what I mean? You know, in relationship, one of the greatest lines that I've ever heard and that I've ever used, because, you know, I'm into women. I'm heterosexual. And women are different than men. Women amongst each other have this really, really incredibly beautiful thing. And that is that they just talk and they listen to each other. And they have this thing where they just talk and they listen to each other. And part of what's going on there for many women is that as they talk about it, they work it out within themselves. And you, when you talk about it, you're hearing yourself, and then you say, well, that doesn't sound right, or you know what I mean? Like, that's a really, really beautiful thing that I see women do with each other. It's almost natural. It's almost like I've seen it everywhere. All women do this with each other. Women just talk. It's something that men have difficulty doing. And there's this really, really incredible phrase that I want to share with you, because it's probably one of the most useful relationship quotes I've ever used. And that is that when my girlfriend, who I don't have one currently, when my girlfriend starts talking, and you know, there's a problem at work and she's kind of going off on some things, I say to her, "Hun, do you want me just to listen, or do you want me to help you with it?" Oh my God, you cannot believe. I'm definitely getting some tonight. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God, it's. She like lights up. She just like lights up. You know what I mean? Like, wow. You know what I mean? Like, you really care. You know what I mean? You really care. I'm telling you guys. Use it today. I swear to you, you're not going to believe what happens. You're gonna. Do you want me just to listen, or do you want me to help you with that? And most of the time, they just want to be listened to. They just want to be listened to. Because this is what they get with their girlfriends. You know what I mean? And, you know, men, we're just like, you know, you don't need to tell me a story. I'm already fixing it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, not in any way they would want it to be fixed, but, you know, I'm in there. You know what I mean? I'm in there. You know, let's take, you know, we're going to take care of it, you know. You don't have to say anything else. I completely get the whole story, you know, with one sentence, you know, like, no, I don't think so. It's really, really beautiful experience. Like, that's spiritual understanding. Then it's talking about showing unselfishness and love under your own roof. You know, it repeats that again. It says that family talk should be constructive, without heated arguments, self-pity, self-justification, and resentful criticism. So it's talking about a bunch of those again. Giving rather than getting will become the guiding principle. Unselfishness. Nothing has helped the man who is off on a spiritual tangent so much as the wife who adopts a sane spiritual program, making a better practical use of it. We shouldn't suggest that their way isn't as good as ours. And maybe try to encourage and get involved with some things that they're into. You know what I mean? Sometimes we can be rigid that, you know, my way is the only way or my way is the better way. Then it says at the very beginning, the couple ought to frankly face the fact that each will have to yield here and there if the family is going to play an effective part in his new life. So it's talking about compromise. It's talking about not being so stuck in our ways. And it talks about thoughtful consideration given their needs. Again, thinking about them, not thinking about myself. Then it says, we absolutely insist on enjoying life. My father wrote a book about multiple sclerosis, and in that book, he talked about the importance of adding humor to our life. Sometimes we're just too damn serious. You know, Rule 64, right? We even have a rule about it, you know what I mean? Try to add humor into your life. And make sure that it's humor, not sarcasm. Sarcasm is the original where that word comes from. Sarcasm comes from is ripping flesh. Sarcasm is it's cutting. You know what I mean? It's cutting. Men do that, and women do it too. But what I mean is that like my whole entire life's relationship with my brothers is we goof on each other. And we are ruthless. You know what I mean? Like, we are just ruthless. It's just the way we are. Like, some people might look from the outside and think that we're angry at each other or something, but we're actually trying to make each other laugh because, you know, like, we're being sarcastic with each other. It's just how our relationship always was. Very often men are like that. But, you know, in most other cases, a softer approach is much better. You know what I mean? Humor is different than sarcasm. Very often, sarcasm is covering something else. Like we're being sarcastic because we have an issue from something 2 weeks ago. You know what I mean? God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery, but if trouble comes, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate God's omnipotence. We're manufacturers of unhappiness. I talked about this previous weeks. We're manufacturers of unhappiness. We don't suffer well, and we don't suffer alone. We drag people around us into it. We're suffering, so we make them suffer. This is no way to live. This is not a spiritual way to live. And then the family afterwards ends with the first three slogans that AA ever had, and that was first things first, live and let live, and easy does it. And notice all three of those are in the chapter about the family afterwards. So it's not speaking to, you know, easy does it by way of how you work your program. It's talking about easy does it by way of in a relationship. All right, I want to... next week I'm going to do a meditation workshop. And I know this is bold, and I know this is cocky, but I'd like to ask if it's okay if the group doesn't make coffee, because coffee tends to stir up the system, and meditation tends to quiet the system. So I want to really have a meditation experience next week. So You guys can do whatever you want to do, but to get the most out of the experience, I would ask that you not make coffee. And then you guys can decide whatever you want to do. And if you make coffee, I'm all right with that. I'm just saying that it's a little contrary, sort of. And then I just wanted to close with this. It's completely random. I was watching this video of a spiritual teacher one time, and it was a week-long retreat. And toward the end of the retreat, this guy got up and he asked the teacher a question. And, you know, it was just another, you know, I don't want my life to be this way, and what do I do about it? You know what I mean? It was another of the long list of, you know, the issue du jour, you know what I mean? Like, you know how the mind is. The mind is a criticism looking for food. You know what I mean? That's what the mind is. It's a criticism looking for food, literally. And so he's sharing the issue du jour. He's sharing, you know, his criticism of some part of his life or whatever. So it was relatively brief, the question that the guy asked. And after he asked the question, you know, they show the questioner, and then they show the teacher. And when it came back to the teacher, the teacher sort of rolled his eyes. I swear he rolled his eyes. And he says to the questioner, he goes, you know, listen, I'm not going to ask your question. I'm not going to answer your question specifically, but I'd like to share something with you that I think will be more helpful. And this is what he said. He goes, let me ask you a simple question. What was your problem 3 problems ago? And the guy goes, I don't really remember. And he goes, what was your problem? Let me make it a little easier. What was your problem 2 problems ago? And the guy goes, I don't really remember. And he goes, all right, let me make this really, really easy for you. What was your problem 1 problem ago? And the guy goes, I really don't know. And then he goes, I would like to suggest that this problem will have the same demise. Thanks for letting me share. Thanks.